That meant tonight is experiencing. Higher than the other. The word expediency, as all good dictionary owners know, all good owners of dictionary, means taking one's foot out. It's expediency to withdraw somebody's foot, to withdraw the foot of one caught by the foot. And any act that extricates you from a difficult position is an act of expediency. Now, ex, out of, and in are opposite concepts. So there is expedient and impedient. The head, of course, is the root of foot, P to F, and B to T. Simple vowel change. So when the foot is caught, then taking the foot out by a device is expediency. When one is impeded, one's got one's foot in a difficulty. And to get one's foot out is again expediency. Now the chief priest says of Christ, when he's being particularly critical of the behavior of the Jews of his day, the leaders of the synagogue, it is expedient that one man should die for the people. Meaning the synagogue, as a corporate body, has got its foot caught. And this base, head, the foot, also means the foundation. There's the F, there's the D. And it's exactly the same word as food, and there's an N in it. And the F becomes P again, which is pound. And the pounding is a verb, as when you beat something very, very hard. Now you remember that the earth is John's footstool, and the sign of Saturn means the centripetal force, or the force that is putting its pedal or foot, or pounding itself, to make a center. The earth is God's footstool means that the absolute free force, in order to create, must precipitate points of reference. Such a precipitating point of reference is a footstool of God. All gross matter is such a footstool. So that the material situation itself is the ped in the word expedient. When we get caught in a material situation, whatever device we employ to get us out of it is a device of expediency. And there are always two ways of looking at the same act of expediency. And the two ways are the way of the individual extricating himself for his own private benefit, and the way of the universal consciousness extricating itself from a situation for a universal benefit. So we have the two pages, the individual private expediency and the universal expediency. One is called lower, the private one, and the other is called higher, the universal one. It's quite obvious that in the New Testament the story is made quite clear. Christ is able to run away at certain times and does so. He annoys the rabbis and then they take him, or try to, and they seek to seize him, and he is not there, he has departed. It is an occasion when he's taken his foot out of a difficult situation that he has created. It is expedient for him to disappear at that time. But the expediency is not for his private benefit. It is because he's going to annoy them some more later until they're sufficiently annoyed to crucify him and make a universal public issue out of it, instead of a private beat up in a small alley where nobody would know what's gone on. They sought to take him, and they would have beaten him in a little back alley and killed him, and nobody would have known, and it would have been of no good to anybody because it would not have been public knowledge and it would not have been debatable by the public. So that when they first try to catch him, he takes his foot out and departs from that place. And no man found him. He has a bigger idea in his mind. Annoy them and annoy them and annoy them until they are determined to kill him, and are so annoyed they don't even care if they kill him in public, which is what he wants. He wants killing in public. He wants nailing up so that everybody will see that he's nailed up, and he wants to talk long enough about why he's been nailed up to become a debating point for a couple of thousand years. Now we know that he succeeded in this because we're still talking about him. There are other people, but they didn't prepare the way. Some of them just snatched a handbag off a little old consul's wife or something, and they were nailed up and nobody cared two hoots about it. They didn't debate the point long enough first, and they didn't annoy enough rabbis first. He was determined to make a universal debating point, and therefore he took his foot out of situations that were too small to justify his death. And he retired from those things, reformulated his criticisms, and came back to annoy them again. And he went on doing this because he had a universal purpose, namely to make a universal debating point about the real meaning of man in relation to man and man in relation to God. We've already seen that the impeding or the creation of the pedestal is by the precipitation onto a centre of forces of the absolute. We'll use the letter Y to symbolise this, or a three-armed cross, because it's the most economic way we can fix a point, stabilise it with three corners. When we put these three lines in here and make the letter Y and show the center precipitated and say that is the earth, that is the pedestal on which we stand, that is the foundation of evolutionary experience, when we've said this, we've said something that has been made possible for us to say because he got crucified. That is to say, he annoyed them so much that they nailed him up. And it became a historic problem later on what kind of cross he was nailed on. And some said he was nailed on a cross like a Greek cross with equal arms, the George cross. Some said he was nailed on a cross with the crossbar slightly higher, like a Latin cross. And some say he was nailed on a cross shaped like a letter T, called a Tau cross. And others say he was nailed on a cross like the letter Y, namely the tree splitting and making it an economic and convenient ready-made thing for hanging men up on with their feet nailed down here, one arm up on each of the two branch lines. I've gone for the Y cross myself because it's more economic and more organic and more likely to have been available at the time than having to do a carpentering job and make a good joint on any of the other ones. There was a simple thing, an existing tree branching out, already made or fastening somebody to, and therefore it's more economic. So if I were going to crucify somebody, I would use a Y cross. But upon thinking about its origin and looking at the Egyptian handle cross, which is a Tau cross with a piece of string added to it, and reading the history of this cross, we find that it means time, as to the lower part, the T, and eternity, as to the circular string above it. So the Crux Ansatum we find on Vatican publications means eternity over time. It's both time and eternity, with eternity on top. Now, it tells us something, that the cross has a meaning other than the immediate meaning of a piece of wood with a string on it. And it meant something to the ancients. That circle of the string meant eternity, eternal recurrence. And the T meant a passive force, the horizontal, and an active force descending below the level of the horizontal. And the horizontal represents the firmament. So that the firmament is the boundary of the finite, and in the finite, down below here, force has involved itself in temporal flow, serial movement. But above this firmament, this binding land of the finite, there is an eternal principle, a principle of power that recurs absolutely and forever. As soon as we think about that, and we know that the Egyptians thought about it in that way, it gives us a little stimulus to think about the other thing. And if we pick up a pair of compasses and draw a circle, and use the circle maker, the compass itself, we know that it cuts this circle into six parts, and we know that we can draw two triangles inside it very easily. And we see that the letter Y, three arm cross, automatically occurs within the circle from the fact of the behavior of the compass. So there's nothing arbitrary about it at all. That this Y cross is inside the circle, and it's an automatic evolution of the use of the compass. So again, it is not only organic, like a growing tree, it is not only economic, being already spread out at the top to receive your arm, it is also an inherent property of the geometry of a circle. So we have another reason to prefer it as a crucifixion symbol. Now we are talking about the crucifixion symbol only because a certain man annoyed a lot of rabbis and got pinned up. People were pinned up often before and since, but they didn't debate like he did. Never man spake like this man, it was said about him. And because of that fact, we can talk about it today and consider the whole problem of what crucifixion means, what the generation of a centre of reference means, what expediency means, and what impedance means. When a force is being impeded, it's because something already exists in its path with mass inertia. Now, if we put a pair of forces in opposition, then they create a zone of rotation. And a rotating force, rotating at a certain velocity, is impenetrable to another force of a lower order. So that in a zone where force is rotating, the application of another force from outside of a lower order is such that the rotating force will be unpenetrated by the other force. The unpenetrated one is then called matter, the so-called simple solid of the street. Matter is solid, meaning impenetrable. And insofar as it is solid and impenetrable, it impedes. Now we have a physical body, and that physical body is a centre of reference for a consciousness which is infinite. Remember, the consciousness of each one of us is infinite, and this we can show because our awareness is always bigger than any object that we can think about. If you think about your own body, where you are sitting on your chair with your legs dangling down and your arms resting on your thighs, if you have any, when you think about it, you're always aware of the binding contour as having beyond it space. That is to say, the binding contour itself is the proof that you are aware of the beyond. If you weren't aware of the beyond, the space, you wouldn't be aware of the form. So if I draw the simple sign of circumscription, the circle, serpent with tail and mouth, the mere fact that I draw the circle forces me to become aware of the space beyond. So as soon as I become aware of a finite, I am forced into awareness of the infinite. Now, if I try to find out how far my consciousness goes away from the reference point of my material body, I can move as long as I can stay awake, outwards away from that body, and I will never find an edge to my consciousness. If I start with this physical body in this room, and I move out to the limit is the wall of the room. If I stretch a bit further, I've already gone into the next door house without permission, I've invaded them and I go out to their wall, and then I get in the park outside. And I keep stretching, and there's always Liverpool beyond, and beyond Liverpool something else. And then the terrestrial globe, again, the earth, with space, and the space as far as the moon, and beyond the moon, and so on. As much time as I have to spare doing this, I can always go further than any existing form I can conceive, and always my awareness is greater than the object than is presented in consciousness, so that my consciousness is infinite. Now this is a very peculiar thing, because although all the bodies of the beings in this room are finite and sitting on separate chairs, the consciousness of each is infinite. And therefore, at infinity, there is absolute interpenetration of the consciousness that is aware of the separateness internal to itself as separate bodies. So that as soon as you begin to leave identification with the given body from which you start, you become aware of other bodies within your field of consciousness. And you also know that every other being doing the same thing is having the same experience. He too is becoming aware of infinite consciousness. Now, infinite consciousness itself is not definable, but plurality cannot exist without definition. So that infinite consciousness that I reach when I break the identification with my centre of reference is not other than the same infinite consciousness that anybody else will reach, and therefore that consciousness is absolutely not other for all of us. This absolutely not other is the same thing that Christ refers to when he says, I and my Father are one. The undefinable consciousness cannot be a plurality, and therefore in a very mysterious way we all participate in this absolutely not other consciousness. And yet, strangely enough, at the centres of it, within it, there are precipitated a plurality of bodies. So when we refer to the plurality of bodies and identify, we tend to believe that our consciousness is plural. And yet we know that consciousness, being infinite, cannot be plural, and yet it has centres of reference within itself. Now, the object of all religion is to persuade a man to let go of the identification with the particular body he starts with, and to expand his awareness to include all the other bodies there are, so that he discovers the absolute consciousness, which is the original precipitator of all these bodies, and to identify with this absolute consciousness in order to become one at the body level with all the other bodies. Now, to do this is the highest aim, to transcend the limitations of the finite body, the finite will, the finite feeling, the finite idea, to go beyond all those finites, to discover one's absoluteness, and to know that it is the same as everybody else's absoluteness. And this absolutely removes all enmity, whilst at the same time allowing the greatest conceivable diversity of unique talents within the precipitated centres within the consciousness. And we're talking about expediency. And there are two kinds. The kind that says, take your foot out of that situation now, because if you don't, it will impede the spread of absolute awareness. This is the higher expediency. And the other kind, the lower, that says, take your foot out of that mess now, because if you don't, you personally and privately will be in a mess. These are the two. We're going to say that there is no middle between these two, that it's always either or. Either you're working towards the spread of this awareness, you're trying to persuade another being to become aware of this absolute non-difference of the consciousness of every being, or you are not. There can be no middle way about it. Either you're working to spread that, or you're not. And if you are not, then you're working against it, because you must work. You can't do nothing without falling apart. That is to say, if you try to do nothing, you become an inorganic, precipitated thing, and you break relation with this absolute. Either you will be relation with the absolute, or you don't. There's no middle point where you can say, I am neither willing nor not willing this relation with the absolute. You can try to find it to compromise, but it doesn't exist. If you examine your motive at any given moment, your motive is either to extricate your own foot from a difficult situation, or to extricate whatever there is to be extricated in order to further the absolute purpose. And there is no middle course. This lack of a middle course is very upsetting to people who are busy in the time process trying to compromise and please God and mammon at the same time. And it's very frightening to men that have to eat daily bread to think that they might not have to fight for daily bread, and they might have to trust that daily bread would come. Christ says, don't bother to ask for it. Your Father in heaven knows what you need before you ask, and if you have the nerve not even to bother to ask and carry on, you will get it. Now those are fighting words, because the whole of the material world is organized on exactly the opposite basis. Even Paul says, not very much later, they who will not work shall not eat. Those are not Christ's words. Lord Paul solemnly says, Christ did not say this, but I say it in the same spirit. Now Paul is talking about expediency. He's saying there are sponges amongst us who are pseudo-Christians, who are not doing what we are doing, but because there is a commune and some rich converts have started giving cash into the till, and we are eating, and poor people are eating, therefore some people are coming in who are lazy. And these lazy people are saying, Christ said, we don't need to work, God knows what we need, so we've come for it. So he is wrapping them on the knuckles about this, and he has an expediency there. We could say it is a higher expediency if he is saying to them, you are deceiving yourselves, this is not the absolute purpose at all, you have come here for a private purpose, namely to take advantage of our new Christian commune's generosity. If he means that, it is the higher expediency. Whereas if he meant, I am in charge of this situation, and if these people come here and eat all the fodder provided by the commune, and if they loaf about the place sufficiently, then my very rich benefactors will get fed up and say, I am not keeping those loafers at all, and therefore I will not supply any more money to your church, and your church will collapse. If he said these things, it would be the lower expediency. Now Paul's motive is here. So we'll go away from that. We know that the time of Constantine the Great and the time of Gregory with his chanting, there was a sudden switch in the behaviour of the church. Quite suddenly, rich people thought it was fashionable to become Christian, and the church began to accept gifts of gold and silver plate. And suddenly, the impoverished Christians became very fashionable. The emperor was converted. It became the thing to do to go to church and to make it nice and luscious and acceptable. So, suddenly Christianity ceased to exist because it had been made official. This is why it is said by some thinkers that when Constantine became converted to Christianity, Christianity disappeared from the face of the earth. There might have been isolated pockets of it still in poverty somewhere. And that which we call Christianity no longer coincided with the Spirit of Christ. And that's a long time ago, if we can go back. Today is 1600 years. To find that Christianity at that time has ceased to exist because it was made official. The church became the left arm of the state at that time. There was a schism, now called a schism, because they don't mean it. And there was a big argument in the church, and the emperor said, this argument is splitting my empire, I require it to be solved. Best thing to do is become converted, and then order them to come to an appropriate conclusion, which he then did. So the church became the left arm of the state and became very fashionable. So the established church in all countries has always done, and it has become an apologist for the state. Yes, as the military is the right arm to hit you very hard if you don't obey, so the church is the left arm to persuade you to do as you are told in order to get heavenly bliss later. Two forms of expediency. We'll put the material horizontal line here, and we'll put a foot in it from below. There's a man below. And you've got one foot in it, we'll put another foot in it, there's another man up here. Now there are two men, both with a foot, in the material situation. Foot might be a euphemism. But certainly when they get in the situation, the two men are both in the same situation, namely the material situation. They're both caught in it, but one is above it and the other is below it. The man who practices a lower expediency is a materialist. He is an atheist. He doesn't believe in a superior intelligence governing the universe. He believes that he must fight for his own private benefit. So we put his foot in the material world and let him hang down below it. He is suspended from it by a foot, like the man in the tower of the But the other fellow, strangely enough, although his foot is caught in it, he's not suspended from it downwards into the gravitational field. He is standing on the situation. The fellow below is never quite aware of what's going on. So as he continuously gets caught in the material situation, in the material difficulties, he can't see very far. He commits himself into a thing, into business, into a relation, into marriage, into something that involves him in the material situation. And in that material situation, he suddenly finds himself caught and unable to move. Now, whatever he decides to do to get out of the material situation, using his own knowledge, whatever device he can fabricate, whatever he does to get himself as a private, finite individual from it, is lower expediency. Now, because this man is, as defined, a materialist, an atheist, a non-believer in absolute intelligence, and therefore for him anything whatever goes. Therefore he can tell lies without compunction at all, because there are no truths other than the truth of the individual purpose in each man, and it's every man for himself. So if this particular man wants to define whales as fish so that they can be eaten or fried, he does so. And he knows that it is not correct, it isn't a true definition within the development of science and vocabulary, but he does it, and it's lower expediency. It is not in order to further universal purpose, it is in order to dispose of whale meat on a Friday. So it is lower expediency, and because an accumulation of such acts in each pope, historically, has weighed upon them, therefore, even officially, no pope has ever gone directly to heaven. He has had to go to be purged of his acts of lower expediency, to purgatory. Now, the higher man is not quite so ignorant. He knows about cosmic law, and he knows that every material situation is simply an expression at finite level of that cosmic law. So he doesn't get caught in the situation in the same way that the man of lower expediency does at all. When he puts his foot in the situation, he does it on purpose. And if he wants to extricate it, having put it in, he can do so. So Christ, who is the type of man giving you this reaction, annoys the rabbis, and they seek to take him, and they want to destroy him, and they take up stones to beat him to death, and they cannot find him. He's taken his foot out and gone away. But later on, he says to Judas, now everything is ready. You go and whatever you've got to do, do it quickly, because I'm ready. Then he goes into the garden to wait to be arrested. Judas does his deed, and Christ is duly arrested and tried. Now, all the way through, he is conscious of the situation he's in. He puts his foot in when he wants to. He looks as if he's going to be caught to stimulate the greedy appetite of the destroyers. And then he withdraws it and goes away. This makes him madder than ever, and they lay better and better schemes to get him. And he goes on doing this to sharpen up their intelligence until they're driven to the point where he has to be crucified publicly after 3 years of solid debate annoying. Now he becomes a universal figure, crucified on my favorite cross, which symbolizes the cosmic fact that every finite being whatever is crucified. Every finite being, having a gross material center of reference, is crucified on the gross matter. If there are any finite beings having centers of reference other than the gross body, like subtle bodies, causal bodies, or anything else you care to fabricate, nevertheless, they are still points of reference. And insofar as they're stabilized points of reference, they are footstools for the consciousness that stands upon them. being so, and because they are stood upon, they are dangerous. The thing you put your foot upon, unless it is absolutely stable, is dangerous. But in the time process, all finite vehicles are not absolute, and therefore if you stand on a finite, you are in danger. Somebody might kick it from underneath your foot, or it might have within itself the dialectical tendency to decay. It lets you down at a certain point. When it does, it's time for you to take your foot out of it. If you take your foot out for a cosmic reason, that's high expediency. If you take your foot out for your private benefit, it is large expediency. Let's look now at some of the implications of this pet, the foot. We said that the P goes to F and the D goes to T. The P can give us pound as a verb, strike violently, and refer to the primary will banging on the center. It refers to found also, which is the foundation of all being, and it refers to food, the precipitation of the energy into the material body, and the taking of that matter, that gross matter, into a body for digestion and assimilation, and the reclaiming of the energy that was precipitated into it. All these are the same word. So that we're on something very basic when we talk about expediency. We have a threefold man with a belly, and a heart, and a head. And we can say, quite easily, that there must be three kinds of expediency of the two papers. Lower and higher expediency must have their representatives in the body at each level. Let's take the lowest level first. We know that there are two appetites here, the appetite for food to get the energy to continue the whole process, and the appetite for sexual relation. The one for food is generalized throughout the whole body and has no external living target for a relational reason. It just wants to assimilate it and reduce it to energy. But in the sexual relationship, it wants a partner in the relationship. And when it enters into a relationship at all, it is equivalent to the absolute energy precipitating itself onto a reference point. As soon as a man enters into a relation with a woman, he puts his foot in it. And he may find later that he wants to take it out again. Now, if he wants to take it out again for an assumed higher expediency, so that he can take the veil or go in the monastery, that's one thing. But if he wants to extricate his foot from the situation because the foot is being pinched by the shoe placed upon it by the lady in the case, then it is lower expediency. And the lower expediency is always wrong. That is to say, it is never aimed at nor able to produce that absolute awareness that we're supposed to be pursuing. So if a man and a woman go into a sexual relationship, whether legal or otherwise, in the social sense, if they go into that relationship, once they're in it, they'll have a job to get out of it on the higher expediency. Because the higher expediency says there is no other. The absolute has no otherness in it. So that if you go into that relation, you can't suddenly define the lady in the case as other than yourself. She can't define you as other than herself. So that very peculiarly, there's no ground for breaking the relation that exists on the ground of the higher expediency. There may be many reasons of the lower expediency, when it's stated in economic, to have a wife. I knew a man once that had a girlfriend, when he totted up what he'd spent each year for 5 years, he found out he'd be cheaper married. And then, because he wasn't the best mathematician in the world, he married her. But immediately her expenditure went up. He found she'd been keeping expenditure down to encourage him to think he'd be a cheap wife. So when you put yourself into a situation, you are putting your power into division, that is into a finite. Once you are in it, you should stay in it to the very term of that relational possibility. That is to say, you must not withdraw from it if the other person won't, because it has within itself, as any other precipitated point, infinite potentialities of significance and expression. So that when you go into the relation, if you proceed to analyze it, no matter how awkward she is, even if she's a damn tippy like Socrates, even if she's the world's champion nagger, nevertheless, by studying the principles of nagging, one can come to universal knowledge, like Socrates did. So the higher expediency will not allow you to take your foot out of that one, not out of the relation as such. But the higher expediency might actually take you away from the physical body of that being in order to be crucified elsewhere, just in the same way that Jesus was taken away from his mother to be crucified elsewhere. It is conceivable that a man might be taken away from his wife to be crucified elsewhere. Only his inner depth would know whether he was going for the higher or the lower expediency. And because most people are not very good at penetrating to the inner depths, they wouldn't know. And certainly, very improbably would they know about the depth motive of another person. And death is at the physical level, there's a significance. So when we come to put our foot in the emotional level, quite independently of a sex relation, it's possible to give somebody the impression that you like them, quite independently of physical attraction. I like you. It's not your brain, it's not your torso, it's your heart. But as soon as you commit yourself into the relation, again the absolute energy has precipitated a reference point. It becomes, again, dangerous. You put your foot in it. You're now in an emotional relationship. You have said you like this person. The natural response of a person on being told that it's liked is to like the like of it. Everybody tends to like to be liked. Suddenly you find that the response of the liked one is to hold on to the liker. And again, it may happen, the time may come when the foot may have to be taken out. And again, the reason may be a private one. The emotional demonstrations of the liked one may be going beyond all bounds of liking into other realms. And at this point, you might have to withdraw. Only your depth motive can tell you whether you're getting up to the higher or the lower expediency. In the same way, at the rational level, you present an idea to somebody, and if this is a good idea, it produces a change in the mind of that person and orientates the person towards you rationally. Again, you put your foot in it. You've said something, and this person responds. And this response begets another statement, and this statement begets another response. Suddenly you're committed into an intellectual relationship. And again, you have to search your depth before you can withdraw from the conversation legitimately. Only if you have an absolute reason for shutting up and saying no more is it permissible. For a private reason, you are not permitted to withdraw unless you have an atheistic materialist, in which case you don't need permission because you only take notice of your own ego center. So here we see the definition is quite simple of expediency higher and lower. Higher refers to the spreading of the awareness of the absolute non-difference of all consciousness wherever it appears. Removing of oneself from a difficult situation is permissible then if staying in the situation would destroy your vehicle of experience and thus retard the spreading of this idea. But if pulling out is done for a private purpose, then it is a large expediency and is cognitively not allowed. But the individual who does it, being a materialistic atheist, won't care two hoots about cosmos not allowing it. But he will pay the price of not caring, because the mills of God will grind very efficiently upon him, because the fact is that the universe causes reciprocal relations between all beings, because ultimately it is an expression of a unifield of power. In any given situation, no matter how delicately balanced, the only way to know whether you're acting from higher or lower expediencies is by examining your own depth motive. And initially this is not easy. Your mind is equipped with defenses. I say your mind. The mind of any socially trained man is full of defenses, full of inhibiting factors, full of special concepts to stop you trying to find your real motive. The old saying that the truth is a naked lady not to be allowed in the drawing room means that if you were to put your pure motive before other people, normally at a good dinner party, they would all complain very, very bitterly. First of all, they would accuse you of being a bore, because they don't want to know about your depth motive, because they don't want to know about their own. So the only way of knowing what to do in any given particular situation is by examining your motive. And if, when you've examined it, if you've been lucky enough to find it, and you can find it only if you sincerely want to, then you will say to yourself, either this motive aims at the furtherance of absolute awareness in all beings of this consciousness, or it aims at a private benefit. If it aims at a private benefit, then the impulse is springing from a finiting concept within oneself. If it does so, and you identify with it deliberately and consciously, you have chosen the losing side, you've chosen the negative side, you've chosen the ignorant side, the deficient side. Because as soon as you become private, you become privated. To be private is to be identified with a finite, limited being. But the finite, limited being has only finite data, and she's therefore unaware of essential materials relevant to the situation it stands in. And because of this, it is going to make mistakes. So every time the impulse to side with the finite in particular and private occurs, the man who wants to shorten his evolution will refuse to identify with it. He will recognize the fact the impulse is there, it is in the flesh. This is called the sin of Adam. The impulse is there in the flesh to say, pursue my private benefit, my private comfort, my private freedom from pain, and so on. But this impulse must not be identified with if one is to evolve properly. Well, we'll do a large diagram so that we can put details into it. Here is a drawing of an egg. This is the nucleus in the egg. Now, if we write the nucleus in here, we find a peculiar meaning about it, that the concept of intelligence is there, and the concept of work is there, and the concept of the best is there, and the concept of an issuing force is there. The nucleus is intelligent, it works, and it is the best, and it sends forth energy. This is the drawing of an egg. If we get a knife and cut a piece off the egg here, the part on the other side of the cut away from the nucleus dies, disintegrates. The part on the side near the nucleus heals. Now this tells us something about the nucleus. It has inside itself formulating power. It has an inner form, and this inner form comes out and imposes its invisible inner form upon this visible substance. This is a very important concept. It tells you, in a sense, how faith can change things. Faith is the substance of things hoped for. Substance does not here mean matter, it means force. And it means intelligent, formulating force. If we look at a drawing by the alchemist of a sperm from a certain period, we find that inside the head of the sperm they draw a little man with his knees up. He's packed exactly like a baby inside the head of the sperm. You can find this in alchemical manuscripts. They thought there was a little man inside the sperm waiting, like a Russian in a Sputnik, to be let out to demonstrate. We know by microscopic examination there is no such man in the sperm. Which is very, very strange, because every sperm of a particular kind of animal will develop into that animal and not another one. Inside the human, there are 48 chromosomes. Strung along those are a certain number of genetic factors. And the number of these in every human being is identical, which means that every human being has exactly the same potentialities in the nucleus. Every human being is in the nucleus as good as every other human being. That's very strange, because in practice it does not appear that this is so. Therefore we have to account for it. We account for it very, very simply by saying that external forces acting on the protoplasm outside the nucleus are able to impede the nuclear forces as they spread through the body. Forces from outside leave records inside this protoplasm, the ordinary mechanistic biology's term. For such a record is an engram, which means that the thing is rammed in, as on a gramophone record. An engram with an emotional charge on it can actually interfere with the pure nuclear truth that is trying to express itself. So if we give somebody a series of very bad stimulus situations, very painful, the somatic zone of the protoplasm becomes blocked with pain guard, defense mechanism. And the protoplasm here is determined not to be hurt. And so when a message comes from a nucleus towards the situation, it can't get through unimpeded. And the same grand pattern here is interfering all the time with the nuclear intelligent message and falsifying it in order to dodge a pain based on a previous experience. And the average man is full of thousands of such engram patterns, which falsify the intelligent nuclear response. Now, quite obviously, if we don't shift the negative emotions from the somatic zone, the nucleus cannot express itself freely. Somehow we've got to find a way whereby it can do so. And the only way available to us is by non-identification with those records inside us. But the thing that keeps us in a state of identification is emotion. It is never the form of the situation as such that does it. It is always the emotional tone upon it. You know, it can't be the form as such, because one girl may be seen by five men and one of them may fall in love with her, one may hate her, one may be indifferent to her, one may think she's like a small child and give her a lolly, and another may think she's an old woman and refuse to talk to her. These are individual responses to one fact. And this tells you the peculiar power of the individual engramic materials here to interfere with and to distort relations. Now, this egg, when developed, is a human being. But peculiarly, in the nucleus, there is not a little man or a little woman. There are just some little strings with knobs on. And the knobs are little precipitated centres of power. But each one of these is the centre of a field of intelligent force, sentient power. Now the little man is not in the nucleus, but the nucleus is in the big man. And the big man is the cosmic man, the Adam and the Kabbalist. The cardinal. That card is the same card in box, little card, caddy that you put the tea in. The man in the box, the cosmic man in the big box, is the field of the human being as such. And that field of the human being as such, the cosmic man, the cosmic Christ, the Logos, precipitates with inside itself the same diagram we use for the egg. Will now do for the universe, precipitates inside itself, centers, and each little center is a reference point through which the cosmic man can proceed to evolve, and therefore the form of the man, instead of being in a
head of the sperm or
in the nucleus really has an opposite relation. The nucleus is in the man, and the man is the universal field, and the field is pressing through the nucleus into the time process. So around every sperm, around every egg, there is already a conscious sentient field waiting the opportunity to enter in and animate that egg. Man is hidden in the field. And this seems very strange until we consider something that we already know a lot about. The Chladni figures, the vibrations, the patterns of vibrations we see when we scatter sand on a piece of plate glass and bow it with a violin bow on the edge, and the sand then moves into certain geometrical figures. Now, a simple experiment of this order shows us that there is form which cannot be seen, but which can be made to be seen by putting gross particles of sand down to be vibrated flat by it. Snowflakes are precipitated in an invisible field of form, the little ice particles which form there to make it are precipitated onto a vibrating wheel. The wheel is invisible. It is a vibration of power. But this power is able to shuffle the little freezing particles onto certain lines and sides of them. So a snowflake is like a visible evidence of an invisible vibrational state at the time of its freezing. The visible world of form is the evidence of an invisible power which is formulating. And at the moment of the freezing, we have a record of the then vibrational state of the field in which it is precipitated. Now, the little man is not in the egg or in the head of the sperm or in the ovum. The man is in the field, and the field is an intelligent formulating power. And that field vibrates and shuffles onto centers whatever forms it wills to express through those forms. Now we know that one of the ends of man is to recognize and glorify God. And we have our cosmic sphere, which is the God, the Logos, God the Son, beyond which is God the Father, and penetrating through it, and yet he is expanding infinitely and is coincident with it. The sphere, this Logos sphere, precipitates within inside itself all the little individual spheres, and in so doing serializes that which is simultaneous in itself, and serializes it as individual human beings. Now in itself it covers all possibilities whatever, but when it precipitates a center and thus makes a human being, that center is unique because the cosmic self intends it to be so. That is to say, the cosmic self precipitates these centers in order to express its own differences, which appear to be potential from below, but which are actual at the cosmic level. It precipitates them into the time process and presents them serially so that its wonderful possibilities of formal expression held in simultaneity in the Logos are precipitated into the time process separately, so that they can be evaluated separately until they're simply fused together. Imagine a jigsaw puzzle in which it's been prepared ready, some picture. When did you last see your father? It's glued to a piece of plywood and it hasn't been sawn yet. And before the saw cuts are made, there isn't much mystery about it. You can see who it is. And after a bit, you get fed up with it. So you get your saw out, and you wiggle it about, and you cut it in lots of little bits, and then scramble them. Now, there's lots of fun with this jigsaw, putting it back together. If you're very rational, you collect all the blue bits together and all the red bits together. Some people think this is cheating. The Greeks had a tendency to do that with the cosmic jigsaw. It's a bit boring, actually, because you know you can win that way from the beginning. Some other people like the adventure, so they just pick up a red bit and a blue bit and tie them together. To their amazement, it fits. The red bit was her hair, and the blue bit was the back of her collar. That's very exciting. So if you want to get the most exciting out of your jigsaw puzzle, you don't bother to sort the bits out first. Now the difference between the finite jigsaw puzzle we've described and the cosmic one is this. In the finite one we have time, and we have a narrow arc of vision and a small picture with a few hundred pieces in it. If we get to 400, that's quite expensive. We know we can defeat the thing in 2 or 3 hours with a cup of coffee, keep us coming. Now the other one is very, very variable, and the number of parts is unknown. The colours are indeterminate, and it isn't even quite sure whether all the parts belong in the same time. So the problem is considerably more interesting. And yet we know that there is a solution. Now the Greeks and some other rationalist philosophers have said we'll sort out all the colours of the universe, all the forms of the universe, and this way we are bound to win. And they left us a heritage of primary geometrical structures, and by means of these we can get a tremendous amount of security. We can say, yes indeed, the circle is the key to this jigsaw puzzle, and the triangle within it helps us to recognise certain types of forms, and the right angle structure of the square helps us to recognise others, and we can precipitate in the circle a large number of geometrical forms if we've got the time. Then we can go out and look at trees, their leaves, the flowers, the petals, cross sections of bones of animals, and to our great delight we'll find that all the geometry we've drawn in the circle appears in nature. This is a fact. We can also start counting and notice a peculiar ratio between them. When we do so and we examine nature again we find this identity. There's a peculiar relation between geometry and mathematics and natural form. Somehow the universe we know is an orderly mathematico-geometrical structure. So we're on the trail. It appears to the Greeks we have solved it. And the Stoics can say, well, we know what it is. It's a circle. It's a logos. And they said, let's take the O and the G and the O and the S and the L. And we'll draw one O, two O's, and we'll draw an S function here to show the issuing of one through the other. And we'll use the letter L form, which is nearly identical, to link them all together. And then it's a continuous issuing from one O to another O, and the whole thing then becomes grossly objectified and is a logos. So the logos, L-O-G-O-S, serialized, is condensed into this favourite diagram of ours, which shows this inner and outer movement and the feeding from the perimeter to the centre and back again of this being which virtually establishes itself and is a true logos. Now when they had said that, the next thing was that what were we going to do about it? And the answer was conform. The Stoics said, whatever else we have got to do, we have to conform to this logos, this rational conform. And those who had enough energy and intelligence to do their geometry properly began to conform to it. Some of their statements survive in modern Freemasonry. Some of them were taken by the Masons, the stonemasons, and the symbols of their craft were used for moral and psychological symbols. But wherever they were, if you had a term, a vertical line, or a line cutting through a centre of a circle in a certain way, and having terms cutting the perimeter called opposites and so on, you could think in a certain way, and relative to the earth line, you could say the upright man is a better man than a horizontal man. Horizontal men are dead and can be kicked about by living men. Living men are not kicked about by dead men, therefore it is better to be alive than dead, because it is better to be at the giving end rather than the receiving end. It is more blessed to give kicks than to receive kicks, and so on. And when they had taken all these geometrical forms, they had the universe tied up, and all they had to do was conform to it, which is very nice. And at the time Christianity appeared, the Stoics had formulated their doctrine of action correspondent to the universal logos. And Christianity had nothing at all comparable to this. Therefore Christianity sparked. Because the doctrine of the Stoics required intelligence, geometrical and mathematical knowledge, logic, and self-control. That's dreadful. And the Christian had to offer in place of it something more economic. And it was a very good thing. They said, you don't need to know anything. All you need is a pure motive. And then you can do what the hell you like. You live by faith, not by geometrical knowledge. Now, which was right? The fellows who had worked it all out and were busy trying to conform to it, or the other fellows? Well, we find that a positive is better, even on stoic analysis, than a negative. But conforming to a geometrical pattern always requires the negating of what you are doing by reference to the geometrical pattern. The geometrical pattern exists, you study it, and then you force your action to correspond. So in your mind you establish the geometrical pattern, you work to do so, and your life is passing like this along the time process. If you want to know what a proper act is, you always refer that to the geometrical pattern. So in a very peculiar way you're being dictated to by your past analysis of what the geometrical fact of the universe is. So the past is dictating to the present. And you're doing this in order to precipitate yourself into a continuously receiving future where, by means of conformity with the absolute, you will be safe from harm. Now there are two men, Epimetheus and Prometheus. After thought and forethought, they committed opposite errors in the Greek myth. One is always thinking about his future, the other one is always worrying about his past errors. Christianity avoided this by saying, you don't have to know whether it is reasonable or not. Either it is or it is not. But whether it is or not, if you keep your mind now, and the now is travelling, and you always keep your motive to remember the absolutely not other, that all the bodies that are precipitates of one heavenly Father, that is the infinite, has precipitated a multitude of finite, and the finites all belong to that infinite Father, that is enough. And the now is travelling. So if we remember this every moment and we always act upon it, it doesn't matter to whom, whether the universe is geometrical or not. Now by the supreme device, this act of faith, millions of people were extricated, they were able to take their feet out of a previous footstool of a previous generation. They were able to free themselves from the dictatorship of geometry, free themselves of the dictatorship of the past, free themselves of fear of the future, because they had seen that the now was travelling, and that if every now is taken care of properly, then it follows that the future is taken care of, and the past is atoned for. Because no being can do better than behave properly now. So in a very peculiar way, he safeguards his future and atones for his past by concentrating on the moving now and keeping only one idea in his head. When I act always from the higher expediency. That is, to further this awareness of the absolute not-otherness of consciousness.